So here in Judges chapter 1, verse 1, Joshua had died. And we're going to be reading the first 20 verses here. We'll just go a little bit at a time, a couple verses at a time, rather than reading all this and then backtracking over it. As they had come into the promised land after the death of Joshua, God essentially broke the backbone of the people that lived in the land, and the Israelites were able to come and dwell there. But just because the backbone had been broken didn't mean that the enemies were all gone, because there were still quite a few. And once they got over there and kind of took control, Joshua divided up the land by tribe. And I do have this PowerPoint up here. Josiah, if you would go down for me one slide there. This is the land of Israel. And it's probably difficult to see everything very well. But what you see are the names of the tribes of Israel in the sections that have color on them. One of the most important things to notice as you look at this is there's this line pretty much right down the middle. And the line that goes down the middle of this land, you see a little lake at the top. That's the Sea of Galilee. And then it ends, as it goes south, in the Dead Sea. And that's kind of the dividing line in this land. When Israel, let me just kind of come over here and try to explain a little bit. When Israel came up from Egypt, they ended up coming up around this side. And when there were other people living on this side of the Jordan River, and they were able to conquer this while Moses was still alive. And these three tribes, actually it's two and a half, Reuben and Gad, and then half of the tribe of Manasseh, which was a large tribe, they were given this land on this side of the Jordan River. It was after the death of Moses, under the leadership of Joshua, that the Israelites crossed the Jordan and came over here. It's hard to see it, but this is where Jericho is at. You've heard about the walls of Jericho falling down. This became, once they conquered Jericho, kind of the launching point for the rest of the conquest of everything on this side that happened during the life of Joshua. And toward the end of Joshua's life, this land was divided up between the 9.5 remaining tribes. The tribe of Judah, which we're going to talk about a lot tonight, and then Simeon in the midst of them. The tribes of Benjamin and Dan, Ephraim, the other half of Manasseh, Issachar, Zebulun, Naphtali, and Asher. And that actually does not add up to all the 12 tribes. There was one more tribe, the tribe of Levi, which was the priestly tribe, and they had not a whole land to themselves. They had specific cities that were scattered about through Israel that they lived in. At this time, the tabernacle, remember the tabernacle was the precursor to the temple. It was this special tent of meeting where God met with them. From all I can gather, the tabernacle was at Shiloh at this time. And as far as like a capital city of Israel, Shechem seems to be the place. It was a Levite city. It was a city of refuge. And when they came together, it was in the land of Ephraim, they would gather at Shechem. It was close to Shechem where there were the two mountain, or there was a valley and kind of two mountainous areas on either side where the Israelites gathered, separated to pronounce the blessings and the curses. So it was a significant place for Israel at that time. But what we're going to do is we're going to focus. Josiah, if you go ahead and go on to the next slide. This is a zoom in here, so you should be able to see this better. I thought it would be nice as we talk about this that you can kind of look up there and see what we're talking about. We're going to be talking primarily tonight about the tribe of Judah and what happened with them. And the title of this first lesson is Starting Off on a Good Foot. I've talked about how the book of Judges, we see this spiral downward throughout the book. But this is the top. This is the good part. This is where we see some really positive things happening, even though we're starting to see a few compromises taking place. So let's start off Judges chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Who would like to read that for us? Josiah.
After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand."
All right. And so a couple things I want to mention here. This is a good thing. Why? Why is what we're reading here in verses 1 and 2 a good thing?
Because
because they ask of the Lord. I want you to just put your finger right here, and I want you to go to the very last chapter and the last verse of this book. Not of this chapter, of this book. Go to the last chapter and the last verse of Judges. And someone read that verse to me.
In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes.
And so Judges ends with there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what they wanted to do. How does Judges start off? The people, the nation, they came together and they asked God, we have this mission from you to conquer this land. We know you want us to completely conquer it. Who should go first? And so we see perfect obedience, good question, good thing going on to where we end up in Judges. And so I think it's really important to kind of see the book ends to this book, because we see there's obviously going to be a moral dive that happens here. How did they inquire of the Lord? What does that mean? It says they came about after the death of Joshua. The sons of Israel inquired of the Lord. How would they have done that? Where would they have done that? What does that look like? Any ideas? I believe that's absolutely what happened. The high priest, I've talked about it before and taught on it, about had that high priestly breastplate that had the stones, 12 stones, one for each of the tribe of Israel. And there was also a special stone that he carried inside this breastplate. Anyone remember what that was called? It was an ephod that he wore. But there was a special stone. Urim and the Thummim.
Is that the stone?
And if you go to Numbers chapter 27, verse 21, if someone wants to just jump over there real quick. Numbers 27, verse 21. Whoever gets there can go ahead and read that for us. We see.
And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of the Urim before the Lord at his word. Shall they go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and the children of Israel, with him, even all the congregation.
So that's the best indication of how that worked. They would go to the high priest, who was wearing that high priestly ephod, and he would have the Urim and the Thummim, and there was some way, we don't know how it worked, but however they used that, whether it was kind of like rolling dice or tossing a coin, or there was some other way of being able to interpret what God was saying, that was how God would give specific direction to Israel many times when they would come and ask God a question as a nation. They would go through the high priest and they would receive an answer. And so it sounds like they went to Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, and they inquired of the high priest. And the Lord's answer was, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand. So God says, it's a done deal. I'm giving this land to Judah. What question should we ask?
Why Judah?
Why Judah? Why Judah? Why would they be the first to go? Any ideas? They were not the tribe of the oldest son. Who was the oldest son of Israel, of Jacob?
Reuben.
And then, after Reuben, Simeon and Levi, and then Judah. Judah was the fourth oldest of Israel's 12 sons. Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, he was the fourth of Jacob's 12 sons. But Josiah, you were hitting upon something that I think is important. What happened on Jacob's deathbed? What did he do?
He blessed the sons of Joseph.
He did He did bless the sons of Joseph and gave them a double portion, which is why instead of seeing a tribe called Joseph up here, we see Ephraim and we see Manasseh. Those were the two sons of Joseph. He gave blessings and kind of prophecies or even curses to an extent to all the tribes. And he went from oldest to youngest. And when he started with Reuben, what did he say? Anyone recall? He said, you can look back at this if you want to, as I'll just kind of summarize it. But back in Genesis chapter 49, I think it's interesting. Genesis chapter 49, so many of the things that Jacob said here on his deathbed, we see playing out now in the book of Judges. And so this was hundreds of years earlier, close to 500 years earlier, I think. That this was said. He summoned his sons in Genesis 49, and he says in verse 3, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity, preeminent in power, uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Even though you're my firstborn, you will not have the firstborn right. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Reuben had an affair with one of Jacob's wives or concubines. And so father said, even though you are my oldest, you will not receive the firstborn right. Then he goes to Simeon and Levi, verse 5. You are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. These are the two that went and smote the people that had married his daughter, Dinah, who had been raped. And their brothers were angry. And rather than letting Jacob resolve all this, they went and tricked the people and killed them all and created a huge mess that Jacob had to then deal with and clean up. In fact, I had to actually move. And he said, you two, my second and my third, you guys are not trustworthy. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's huge, because what happened to the tribes of Simeon and Levi? Simeon, we're going to read about in a little bit, is kind of scattered in Judah, and Levi is the tribe that had no land of their own. They had cities and were scattered throughout Israel. He had no idea that Levi would be the high priestly group. He makes a prophecy, a sort of a curse on his deathbed, and here we see when the land is divided up all these years later, it's exactly what's happening. So the blessing of firstborn did not go to number one. It did not go to number two or number three. Number four, in verse 8, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. So we're seeing this preeminence. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who dares rouse him up. The scepter of rulership shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and unto him shall be the obedience of all the peoples. This is a prophecy of who? Who would be born? Jesus was born of the tribe of Judah. And so we see the right, the special privilege of firstborn falling down to number four, to Judah. And so we're seeing, why would Judah be told to go up first? Because they had the firstborn right that came as a result of being the sons, the children, the tribes of Israel. And so they were first to go up. And they were, in fact, one of the largest tribes, if not the largest tribe. any questions or comments about that? Kind of interesting. See all this playing out. So we move on. Verse 3. Judges chapter 1, verse 3. Who'd like to read that for us? Micah.
And Judah said to Simon, his brother, come up with me into the territory of the Lord, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory of the Lord. Simon went.
So we read here about Judah and Simeon. Now, Judah told Simeon, the tribe of these two tribes, so thousands of people in each tribe. The tribe of Judah said to the tribe of Simeon, "Look, you come with us. You fight with us, and we'll fight with you, and we'll help each other take care of this land." Why would Judah ask Simeon to come? Why would Judah ask Simeon to come? Geographically, Simeon was given land in the midst of Judah. If you go back to Joshua chapter 19, we read in verse 1, "Then the second lot fell to Simeon." So this is the dividing up of the tribes. "The second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah." And in verse 9, it talks about all the cities in verses 2 through 8. "The inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance." And so God providentially worked all this out. So Jacob's prophecy was fulfilled, and Simeon's was scattered in Israel. And even that drawing of Simeon's territory probably is much larger than what their land really was. What's also significant about Simeon is the last time that there was a census taken of Israel, Simeon was the smallest tribe. The smallest. 22,000 men who could fight. While Judah was the largest tribe. I think there were 70-some thousand or more men who could fight. What's interesting about this? What do we see that's kind of pictured for us here? I will tell you, the result of them coming together was good. It was good. I think we see a picture of what we read about in 1 Corinthians 12, where it talks about, "Let not the hand say to the eye that I don't have any need of you." And even those, what seems like a less important part has great importance because God's made it important. He wants the whole body to act together and to work together. At this point in time, all 12 tribes were not coming together to fight together anymore. The tribes from the eastern side of the Jordan had gone back to their area. They weren't fighting together like they were under Joshua. The other tribes weren't joining in on this. They weren't helping out. It was just going to be Judah, each tribe for themselves, to take care of the land that they were given. But Judah and Simeon agreed to work together. And that ended up being to both of their benefit, because what we're going to see from them is going to be the best of what happened in cooperation during this entire book. And so there is a blessing, a picture of a blessing when God's people cooperate. When the stronger values and includes the weaker. Both were blessed by this alliance. Any thoughts or questions? It's a good lesson for us to consider.
Yes, I'm just wondering, when the two nations split, one nation split into two, northern and southern, it was Judah and Dan that were two, and the other 10 were north. And Simeon at that point disappeared?
Simeon is probably the first tribe of Israel that just disappears. You really don't hear much of anything about it. Too much farther down in Israel's history. They just were kind of really literally dispersed. And
I'm sure their land they occupied changed a little bit too to that point, probably.
There were fluctuations and all that. And that's why when Israel eventually split, they split along the lines of Judah there, and everything north became what was called Israel, and then everything south was called Judah. That's why Jews are called Jews because it's short from Judah, which was the prominent tribe that comprised the southern kingdom. So Jew is short for Judah. Now, there were Jews, Israelites, from the northern kingdoms that did come down to live in Judah. But everything got kind of mixed up to a large degree. But a lot of Jews still knew where they came from. Saul, who we know as Paul in the New Testament, he was from the tribe of Benjamin. He knew what tribe he came from. And so even though Judah was the prominent tribe, it wasn't the only one that still existed, even after things got switched up a bunch. Any other comments or questions? So let's read verses 4 through 7. Verses 4 through 7. Who would like to read that? We're going to talk about defeating Adonai Bezek. Defeating Adonai Bezek. Casey, you look like you would like to read. All right. This is an interesting passage. We read about them taking over lots of places. But why is this detail recorded here for us? That's one of the questions. When I come across this, it's like, you know, there's so many things they could say. Why did they say this? Why did God choose to keep this here for us? So when Judah started off this campaign with Simeon, first place they came to was Bezek. And I'm trying to look at the map here and see exactly where that was at. And I'm not seeing it up here. When you don't see it, that means they don't know exactly where it was at. And so you don't see the name up there. But this was a significant place. There were 10,000 men at Bezek that they killed in battle. And then there was this guy, Adonai Bezek. Who was Adonai Bezek? He was a king. The king of Bezek, of that city, of that area. How do we know he was the king? What's the first part of his name? Adonai. What does that mean? Means Lord or Master. So he was the Lord or Master of Bezek. That's what the name means. And so they caught this guy. And what is significant about what happens to him? What is significant about what happens to him? And what does that tell us about everything that's starting to go on? Let me ask this question. What is significant about what doesn't happen to him?
They don't kill him.
They don't kill him. Is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 20 and look at verses 16 through 18. Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 through 18. We read there, "Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave anything alive that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite and the Perizzite." Remember that, the Canaanite and the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite, "as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. So what is God's commandment? They went and they fought the Canaanites and the Perizzites. They found Adonai Bezek. What were they supposed to do with him? Kill him. They were supposed to wipe out these people. Why? Why wipe them out? So they would not be a bad influence on them. But what did they do with Adonai Bezek when they caught him? They cut off his thumbs. They cut off his big toes. We know, number one, it wasn't right for them just to leave him alive. But what do they do with him? They did to him what he had done to others. They adopted this Canaanite ethic for how they would treat captives. Now, why would you cut off someone's thumbs and their big toes? Huh? If you don't have your big toes, you have a lot less balance. And you can't grab things. So when it comes to fighting with a sword, good luck fighting with a sword when all you can do is grip with this. I mean, that thumb is really important to grip that sword. And so if that king, who probably got to be king because he was a good fighter, right? If you were to fight him and all he can do is hold on to that sword or whatever with four fingers and not a thumb, he would not be nearly as scary. And if he were to try to run away from you, he doesn't have any big toes. How good is he going to be at running away from you? Not very good. So this guy is pretty much harmless in a sense. And what do they do with them? They took him to Jerusalem, which is interesting. So they didn't kill him. They took him to Jerusalem and he died there. We don't know if he was taken to Jerusalem and they killed him. The sense was that he just was taken there and that's where he lived out the rest of his days. Is kind of what I seem to get from it. But he just didn't get to go and do whatever he wanted. What was his position? He was picking up the scraps under the table. What does that? A dog. They took this man who was a king, they cut off his thumbs, cut off his toes, and basically made him like a dog. Picking up scraps under the table. Now, That's torture, okay? That's really not humane treatment. And not only did they let this guy live so he could continue to be an influence, but they treated him in a really disgraceful way. And so you see them picking up. This isn't something that they learned from God. This is something they picked up from the Canaanites. And they start to let some of these things influence them to a degree. And he was taken to Jerusalem. We'll read more about Jerusalem in a minute. But what does Adonai Bezek recognize? This is kind of significant too. He recognized, this is what I've done to other kings when I captured them. He said, I've done that to 70 kings. And now it's happened to me. This was fair. It's fair for God to allow this to happen to me. And so we're starting to see compromise. But we're also seeing an important statement from a significant ruler that what is happening to them is fair. Because that is ultimately what God is doing as he's bringing Israel in. God told them, I'm not bringing you in because you all are so righteous. I'm bringing you in because the people of this land have become so wicked and judgment needs to be brought against them. And so we have this little statement of this ruler early here in Judges saying what's happening is fair. There was even a self-recognition of wickedness. We don't get such insight later in this book. Any comments or questions? So we go on to verse 8. We just mentioned this city. Who wants to read verse 8? Charlie.
Now the children of Judah have fought against Jerusalem and have taken it.
Okay, so do they do good? They come to Jerusalem. And it says they capture the city, struck it with the edge of the sword and set it on fire. Did they do good? Yes. So they got Jerusalem, right? Well, if you go down to verse 21, jump down to verse 21 in the same chapter. It says, "But the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day." So this gets kind of confusing. I thought that the people of Judah had just taken Jerusalem and they set it on fire and they took the city. But then you read about the tribe of Benjamin and their interaction with Jerusalem, and there were Jebusites that lived there and they didn't kick them out. They just let them live there. What is going on? Look at the map. Where is Jerusalem? If you look and you notice on the color here, where is Jerusalem?
In the tribe of Benjamin.
Jerusalem here is actually, Benjamin is this darker green and Judah is the lighter green. Benjamin, or Jerusalem, is on the border of Benjamin and Judah. And it sounds like Jerusalem was pretty large. And there was a southern portion of it that Judah was able to take. But a northern portion within Benjamin's land that they were not able to take or did not take later. And the Jebusites in that northern portion continued to live there. So Judah got control over the southern portion, but Benjamin did not get control over the northern portion of Jerusalem. That's the only way that will seem to make to reconcile these passages together. And it makes sense when you look at the map and the geography as to what is going on. We read later that David took over the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites in 2 Samuel. And so apparently it all came back under their rule later. And David had to reconquer it. It became known then as the city of David. You hear about that when we talk about the Christmas story. Talks about born to you, the city of David. I forget exactly how that goes.
Bethlehem turned out to be the city of David. That's where he made.
Bethlehem?
Just south of Jerusalem.
City of David? Okay.
His home there, I think.
Okay.
And built, there's an extension that goes down from Jerusalem that was called the city of David.
Okay.
That he fortified
there on Bethlehem. So there's a connection there between all of that.
But when David conquered him, he killed him, made him slaves, servants. So even then
there was compromise. Yep. Any questions about Jerusalem? So we go on to verses 9 and 10. It says, "Afterward, the sons of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, living in the hill country and in the Negev and in the lowland." So Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba. And they struck Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. So the next thing we see about Judah is they go and they've gotten Jerusalem and they've gotten Bezek. And they spread out this campaign, and they come down to area, the hill country, and this area over here, I believe, and then the area of the Negev. What is the Negev? You see that word come up in Scripture sometimes. What is the Negev? I'll tell you, it's this. I believe it's this area down here in the southern part of Judah. And what do you notice about the southern part? What do you see down here?
Hills.
You see many cities down here? Why is that?
Desert.
It was a desert area. So remember that in the back of your mind. When you read, you'll read about Psalms. In the Psalms, you'll read about the Negev, or sometimes it's spelled N-E-G-E-B. That's referring to a desert area. Okay? Area without much moisture. That's going to come into play here and again in a minute as we continue to read. But they start taking over this area. They take over Hebron, which was a major city, about 19 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Hebron would later become David's capital city when he ruled over Judah. So it was a big city. But it mentions specifically three guys that they wiped out. Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Who were they? Why were they significant? Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. Deuteronomy 9, verses 1 to 3. Who'd like to read that for us? Okay.
Hear, O Israel, Israel, thou art to pass over Jordan this day, to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven, a people great and tall, the children of the Anakim, whom thou knowest, and of whom thou hast heard say, who can stand before the children of Anak? Understand therefore this day that the Lord thy God is he which goeth over before thee as a consuming fire. He shall destroy them, and he shall bring them down before thy face. So shalt thou drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord hath said unto thee.
All right. It's also important, Sister Amy just read that, to also look here in Judges chapter 1, verse 20, because it's really a cross-reference. They gave Hebron, which is this area they just captured, to Caleb, as Moses had promised, and he drove out from there the three sons of Anak. And so that Shishai, I pronounced his name correctly? I'm not sure. Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai were three sons of Anak. And what did Amy read there in Deuteronomy 9? What was significant about these sons of Anak? They were giants. And so like Goliath that David later faced, these were giants. Extremely large men who were skilled warriors. And so defeating these three was a big deal. It really was probably the thing that turned the battle in their favor. And who was it that we see there in verse 20 that was the one behind that victory? Caleb. Who was Caleb? Caleb was one of the spies. If we were to go back in time over 40 years, when the Israelites first came out of Egypt and they came to the edge of the promised land in the south, they sent 12 spies. Why 12 spies? One spy for each tribe. And Caleb was the spy from the tribe of Judah. Joshua was another one of the spies from the tribe of, anybody know? Ephraim. Joshua's from the tribe of Ephraim. They all went over. They all saw the land. They all saw the land was great. But they also saw that there were giants, the sons of the Anak, right? And others, and big, huge cities, very scary. And so when they came back, what did the 12 spies say? 10 of them gave a bad report, saying there's no way we can take this land. 2 of them said, we can do it. God will be with us. Who were the 2 spies that gave a good report? Joshua and Caleb. Joshua was the one who led them into the promised land, and he died. Caleb was still alive, and Caleb was still kicking. You'll read about him later that even though he was an old man, he was still just as strong as he was the day he went up as a spy. God had gave him very good strength as an old man. And he was the one who led the defeat of these three giants, these giants that he saw when he came in as a spy. And what I think is neat is that because he was faithful, God allowed him the power to realize what he had believed over 40 years earlier. That was a long wait. But because he was faithful, God allowed him to realize the fullness of what he had believed could happen over 40 years earlier. Caleb was the last of his generation alive. Everyone else in his generation had died off. So that's, I think that's a really powerful message for us to encourage us. Any comments, questions before we move on? So we're going to see something else that's really important, really good here. Let's read verses 11 through 15. Brother Chris, would you read Judges chapter 1, verses 11 through 15 for us?
And from thence he went against the inhabitants of Debir. And the name of Debir before was Kirjath-Sefer. And Caleb said, he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer and take it, to him will I give my daughter to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's youngest brother, took it, and he gave him his daughter to wife. And it came to pass when she came to him that she moved him to ask of her father a field, and she lighted from off her ass, and Caleb said unto her, what wilt thou? And she said unto him, give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a south land. Give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the nether springs.
All right. So this is another one of those things. You read this account that we just talked about Caleb. He's an old man, but he's still strong. And he's part of this conquest that's going on after Joshua died. And it comes to the city of Debir. And he says, whoever leads a group to go conquer this, I'll give him my daughter for a wife. And one man, Othniel, who was actually related to Caleb, he rose up and he captured it. And so Caleb gave him his daughter and gave an inheritance to her of the Negev. What's significant about the Negev? It's desert. And what does she say? I need water. If this land is going to be worth anything, I need irrigation for it. That makes sense, right? And so she appealed to her father, and he gave her two springs, upper spring and a lower spring, that would allow that land to become fruitful. Otherwise, you gave me a bunch of desert. Thanks. Right? Why is this here? Why is this here? Anyone have any ideas before I tell you what I think? Huh? She was smart, wasn't she? One of the important things that we need to do here in chapter 1 is compare chapter 1, the beginning, where we start, with where we end. And that's one of the reasons, I believe, the primary reason why this account is in here. What does Caleb do that's good in this passage? What does Caleb do here that's good? He listened to his daughter, right? It was his daughter that said that, yeah. That was good.
Encouraging somebody to wipe his...
And was it someone else who was his age? Who was it?
Othniel.
Who was the next generation, right? What is significant about that? He didn't make his daughter marry some old guy. That's good. Yeah, that's a good thing.
He's teaching the next generation to do what God said, to wipe them out.
Exactly. He is, in doing this, he is helping to disciple the next generation. He is teaching them to be warriors, to trust God, to have faith. I don't have to be...
Also, he saw what would happen to his generation when they didn't follow the Lord.
Yep.
A perfect example to look back on, and a perfect opportunity now to teach them to do things the right way, otherwise without.
Exactly. And this, what is one of the biggest failures of the book of Judges? not following his command, but you'd have one generation that would rise up and follow God. And what would the next generation do? God who? Who was Othniel? Anyone know who Othniel is? He is the first judge we read about. I think that's really significant. Othniel, as we'll look in Judges chapter 3, the very first judge that will rise up to deliver Israel is Othniel. And who was Othniel discipled by? He was discipled by Caleb from that previous generation. And so we see Caleb's effort here. He could have gone and done it. He was still strong enough. In fact, he'll talk about that later. He was still strong enough, but he saw a purpose in getting that next generation invested in the future of the country. And that not only blessed that man and gave him a good husband for his daughter, but it blessed Israel when they came under attack from other people. And so it's the same Othniel that becomes the first judge of Israel. Another thing that's really important, and my mom mentioned it, he listened to his daughter. His daughter was smart. She had something worthwhile to say. And he listened to her. He respected her. He took her input, said it was good. He valued her. And because of her wisdom and her position, their family inherited a greater blessing because of it. We know one of the big problems of judges is that they fail to disciple the next generation. But what is the contrast we see about the value of women at the very end of the book of Judges? A man had a concubine. And when these men attacked, he threw out his concubine for the men to abuse her, and they abused her until she died. Then he took her and divided her into 12 pieces and spent her body across the country to the 12 tribes. You see this total change in the way women are valued. And someone might look at this in chapter 1 and say, well, he's giving her away, you know, to a man, and that's not very progressive. Well, you look at it, we're looking at it through American 21st century eyes, but at this point in time, he's securing a good husband for her. And he was valuing her. He listened to her. He respected her. Versus what you see at the end of Judges, where they picked up all this Canaanite culture and all this wickedness and the way they treat women at the end. And so I think one of the reasons we see this is because it shows us this little picture of where they were and then how far they fell to the very end of this book. And so God has got purpose in all these things. There's going to be times that we're going to have no clue why it's in there. But I think that's probably a good guess as to why that's going on. Any other comments or questions on that? Let's look through the rest of this here quickly. I'll move on so not to take up too much more of your time. Verse 16 of chapter 1, the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms, which was Jericho. Jericho was the city of Palms, with the sons of Judah, to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad, and they went and lived with the people. So, the Kenites, who were they? Not Abraham's father-in-law. Moses' father-in-law. Who was Moses' father-in-law? Jethro was his name. Right? And he gave Moses good advice. They had apparently stuck with them. Moses had made a promise that if you guys stick with us, if you help us, you know the way we're going, if you kind of act as scouts, whatever good God does for us, we'll do for you. And so they had stuck with them. And they were there at Jericho, which is where the people came over initially into the promised land. And they went from the city of Palms, Jericho, down into this land. They seemed to be connected most with the tribe of Judah. And as they go down there, what do we read that they do? Settled with who? Huh? It doesn't say that they settled with the people of Judah, although they were in Judah's territory. It says they went and they lived with the people. It's a little bit ambiguous, hard to say for sure. But it didn't sound like they conquered anybody. It sounds like they just went and moved in. And we're going to see more and more of that happening. It's really important as we read through this to pay attention to the language of what's going on, because not everybody is handling every situation the same way. And these Kenites are descendants of Jethro. Jethro was the priest of Midian. The Midianites. They were a Midianite people. And I don't know that the Midianites that Gideon had to deal with came from them, but it was from the same bigger group that they came from, and they were a problem for Israel. Mom?
Was the Moses' father-in-law, didn't Moses get his wife in Egypt during those years?
It was not in Egypt. It was when he went out of Egypt
to
escape. He went into the Sinai Peninsula area someplace.
So I'm just thinking maybe these were immigrants to that area, and so maybe they didn't think as much about other immigrants, you know, just like me, type of thing.
It could have been part of, you know, they hadn't really assimilated into Israel to be part of Israel per se like that. There are definitely some differences. I mean, they were definitely a distinct people. And so that may have played into why they did what they did or how they did what they did. It's a good point. Anyone else have a question or thought? So now it's Judah's turn to keep their end of the bargain. Verse 17, then Judah went with Simeon, his brother, and they struck the Canaanites living in Zephath. And utterly destroyed it. Is that good?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So the name of the city was called Horma. I want you to notice something. So they went, you can see down here where Horma's at. It's on the kind of right-hand side of Simeon's territory. What do you notice happens when they utterly destroy a city? Look at this verse 17, but also look back at verses 10 and 11. What happens when they totally destroy a city?
They're blessed.
It's a blessing.
They change the name.
In every one of these passages where they've completely wiped out a city, they say, this city used to be known as this, but now it's this. What is significant about changing a name?
You're starting new, getting rid of all the old, trying to get rid of everything out of there, like God said. Take yourself totally away from that. Don't be influenced by any of it, even the name, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's a new identity. It's a signal of authority. When God... When Jacob got saved personally, I think he was saved when he was wrestling with that angel overnight. That's my opinion. It was in that event. And it was then that God changed his name. That's a signal of authority. You know, God gave him a name that meant something, but it was also he belonged to God. And it was after that Jacob's language changed. He no longer talked about God as the God of my fathers. He was his God all of a sudden. And so it was personal to him. And when the people took over a city, wiped it out, they were able to name it. It showed that they had authority over that city. And so that is a significant thing when they give it a new name. And they give it a name that means something. And the name Horma means destruction. We obeyed God. We did what God said. And so that city was the name was a memorial to being obedient to God. And I think that's, you know, can be true in our lives when we conquer what God would have us to conquer, and he gives us by his grace authority over that, it becomes a significant memorial in our life that's meaningful. Anyone have a thought or comment about this?
Abraham and Simon the Peter and Saul and Paul.
Yeah.
And someday we're going to get there.
Yep. Absolutely. So Judah fulfilled their end of the bargain, kept up with Simeon. We're going to finish up here, verses 18, 19, and 20. And Judah took Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. Then they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had promised, and he drove out from there the three sons of Anak. And so that kind of repeats what we saw happen earlier. The Lord was with Judah. We see them having all this success, but we run into one obstacle as we come to the end of this section, talking about Judah. What was the last obstacle? They did not drive out the people of the valley. So some of these river valleys here in Judah, who lived in some of these river valleys? Canaanites. But there are Canaanites in other places. What was unique about these Canaanites? They had iron chariots. Now, why couldn't they drive them out? They had defeated giants. They had wiped out so many other people. 10,000 men at Bezek. Why couldn't they wipe out these people with iron chariots? Because they didn't follow God's orders? We're not told exactly why. I think it could be one or more of five different reasons. There could be some unnamed disobedience that went on. We'll talk about that in Judges 2. Sometimes because they were not obedient, God would not help them. And so that could be what it was, like Josiah said. It could be that God left them there to test their ongoing faithfulness, to see, will you continue to be faithful to me, to let them have that eventually. Number three, it could be, and this is something we'll read in Judges 3 at the beginning, that God would sometimes allow there to be nations remaining to teach the next generation how to fight, so that they would learn how to fight and what it means to overcome the adversaries of God. Could be number four, that their faith failed. You go back to Joshua 17, you read back in there, Joshua knew about the iron chariots, and he didn't see that as being a big deal. He knew they had iron chariots and said, well, we'll take them out. But maybe their faith failed. Maybe they saw the iron chariots and were just like, I don't know how to deal with this. And so they just gave up before they even started. Or maybe one of the things you read about in Exodus is the Lord said, I'm going to not give this land to you all in 1 year. I'm going to do it incrementally as you get bigger and you're able to subdue it, lest the land just go to waste. And so perhaps part of it was that Israel hadn't grown yet enough to be able to take over and control that land. So God didn't let them have it yet. It could be some combination of all that. I don't know with certainty, but those are some of the things that we see as reasons why that may not have happened. Any thoughts on that or questions? If not, there in verse 20, we again see that reminder that God kept the promise that Moses made to Caleb because of his faithfulness. And what I want you to notice about this, I think it's really encouraging. There were lots of things that could have happened that didn't happen in this book. We're going to get, as we go in farther in this chapter, we're going to go from this starting off on a good foot to everything just kind of going the wrong direction. Okay? Lots of failures. Lots of things that could have been that weren't. But those who were faithful, God made sure that they received their reward. And that's a really important lesson for us today. It can be easy to be discouraged by all the wickedness that goes on around us, to be discouraged by what other people are doing or not doing. All those things that can really tend to suck the life out of us spiritually. But at the end of the day, if you are faithful, you will not lose your reward. God will bless you for your obedience. You may not see it right away. You may be like Caleb and you may have to wait a long time. But you will see the end of your faith. You trust God. You remember what God did for Caleb, because God is just as faithful today as he was back then. And he will reward those who love him, who follow him. You will in no wise lose your reward. And so I want to leave us tonight on that note. I think it's a very positive and encouraging note that we need. But to just keep our eyes on the Lord, seek to do what he would have us to do, and just trust him to be who he says he is, a faithful, loving, just God, gracious God.